The following message is a teaching by Dr. Jason DeRoshi, Associate Professor of Old Testament at Bethlehem College and Seminary in Minneapolis, Minnesota. More information about Jason can be found at deroshi-meyer.org.
Say the seven stages with me. Just put them to your lips. And as you do, try not to look. But I'm expecting you at this point to have to look. So let's just go through it. K, kickoff and rebellion. I, instrument of blessing. N, nation redeemed and commissioned. G, government in the land. D, dispersion and return. O, overlap of the ages. M, mission accomplished. So here we have four little windows that I've drawn attention to. One is the patriarch Abraham with his son Isaac. And then we move to three key promises that are given. And together they testify to God's unbelievable kindness. Through Abraham, one people group is being set apart. Consider where we've come from. All of creation. Then Adam will represent all of humanity. Then we move to Noah, who is a subset of all humanity, who alone is preserved in the ark. Then we narrow to Shem, who is a subset of living humanity. And then from Shem, we narrow in and go to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. So Genesis begins with all the world and ends with Israel. That's Jacob's other name. It begins with all the world and gives clarity. This is why, all of our Bibles, Old Testament is focused on Israel. What is Genesis then? It's the kingdom prologue. It's giving clarity to where Israel fits in the whole world. All the world is not here for Israel. Israel is here for the world. The world has a problem. And God sets apart a people at the center of all the world through whom he will bless the nations. The promise of offspring is stars. The promise of a home. And the promise that blessing would come, overcoming curse in the north and in the south. I've got to think where you are. Wherever the east is. And the west. So, we've got a patriarch and a son. We've got the promise of offspring. Ultimately, it's one single offspring that Abraham is longing for. That's what he's putting his hope in. And Sarah, his wife, is barren. That adds a twist into a story that is filled with generations and the promise of an offspring. It would take a miracle. Oh, how about a homeland? That'll be easier. Not really. He's coming in as a foreigner into Canaan, and land is not purchased. Land is hereditary, and you don't give up your turf. How could he have it? It would take a miracle. And the blessing reaching all the parts of the earth. Here's our key verse. Genesis 12, 1 through 3. Now the Lord said to Abram, go from your country and your kindred and your father's house to the land that I will show you. Every kingdom needs property. And I will make you a great nation. Hear that. A nation. And I will bless you and make your name great. I'll stop there. Three things. A great nation, blessing, and a great name. There will be both property and progeny. There's a people and a land, and then in the back of our mind, we're remembering that a male offspring was to come from the woman who would be the great deliverer. Does that male offspring have anything to do with Abraham? Like he could maybe be the king of this nation? Then we get, even though you don't see it in the ESV as clearly as I wish it was, there are actually two commands in this text. but it only looks like there's one. Go from your country. But that last word in verse 2, be a blessing, that's actually a command in the original text. The way that it's worded, it comes only as a result of going, which is why they've worded it like a result, so that you will be a blessing. But I don't want us to miss the fact that the be a blessing is part of the command. Go, Abraham. And once you go, stage one, you're going to become a nation on a specific turf. We're going to call them Israel, and I'm going to plant them in the land of Canaan. And it's going to be the promised land, and it's going to be like a picture of the Garden of Eden. Israel's going to be commissioned to be imagers of God, like Adam was commissioned. They're going to bear the responsibility of displaying the greatness of God to a world that is dark and blind and dead. And once they're a nation, be a blessing. Because only when they're a blessing will the remaining promises come to fruition. I will bless those who bless you, and the one who dishonors you I will curse. And here's the kicker. In you, all the families of the earth will be blessed. That's the problem. Look it up here. How many times the word blessing shows up? I will bless you, verse 2. Be a blessing, verse 2. I will bless those who bless you. Two more times. And then in you all the families of the earth will be blessed. In these three verses, blessing shows up five times. In Genesis 1 through 11, the word curse shows up five times. It seems like God is intentionally overcoming curse, 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 blessing. This is overwhelming mercy. God's just declaring hope. All the hope of the world is going to rest on this man and his family. Abram. But just a few verses before chapter 12 in 11:30, it says Sarah, his wife, was barren. It's intriguing that here all the rest of the world are called the families, because normally they're called nations and Israel is called a people. But in this verse, Israel, the ones who will become Israel, are called a nation. And everyone else are called families. What would that mean? Why would he do that? Well, back at the very end of chapter 10, where it talks about the table of nations, all those who were dispersed, 70 families, it says, came out of the Tower of Babel. And one of them is Abraham and his family. This one man will rise and become a nation. And through this man, as the father of this nation, a whole multitude of other families. The sense I get is this. The 70 families get dispersed all over the world. It doesn't prefer the term nation. It prefers the term family in chapter 10, suggesting that all of those nations become the mission field of Israel. Because all the families of the earth, 70 of them, will be blessed through Abraham. That the reason it chooses families is to identify the mission field of Israel. A people for the fame of God's name. Why does God set apart a people for himself? Isaiah 43, bring my sons from afar and my daughters from the end of the earth, everyone who is called by my name, whom I created for my glory. The world is filled with those who fall short of God's glory, fall short of displaying his glory. They're not operating as the telescopes magnifying his greatness. God called a people to himself as displayers of glory, for his glory, to lift him up, to show that he was great. In love, he predestined us for adoption, says Paul, for adoption as sons through Jesus Christ, according to the purpose of his will, to what end? To the praise of his glorious grace, with which he has blessed us in the beloved. So here's Abram. He's either way down in Ur, far left, or he's in an Ur up by Haran, which is where he stopped off. Regardless, we know he makes his way all the way down to Israel, right at the southern part, southeast corner of the Mediterranean Sea. By faith, we're told, he obeyed and went. How does that work? Now the Lord said to Abram, go from your father's, from your country and your kindred and your father's house to the land that I will show you. I'll make you a great nation and I will bless you. What could cause a man to do something so radical as leave all of the comforts of his home to go to a place where he owns no territory? He's following promises that are actually ridiculous because his wife is barren and he's going to become a nation? What would cause a man to, according to Joshua 24, all of Abraham's family were moon worshipers in Haran? What would arrest a pagan out of that culture to follow a god like this? Stephen, in Acts chapter 6, just before he gets stoned, meditating on this text, he says, the God of glory appeared to Abraham while he was in Mesopotamia. Where does he get that? Why does he call God the God of glory when looking at this text? This is crazy that he would leave family, comfort, to follow a promise of nationhood with a barren wife and go to a land where he owns nothing. Why would he do it? Believe me, he will not obey unless he believes. He has to believe that God is trustworthy, that God is believable. And that's not enough. He has to truly believe that the promises are desirable. The obedience that is being called for here is an obedience that will only come as a fruit of faith, because he is going to have to trust God to do for him what he knows full well he can't do on his own. And Paul, looking back to the life of Abraham, says, Christians, watch closely. He's a model of faith. God brought him outside and said, look toward the heaven and number the stars if you're able to number them. Then he said to him, so shall your offspring be. God, my wife's barren. I don't have a son. Right now, Eliezer of Damascus is my heir, but he's not my seed. When we read Genesis 15, we have to fit it in the story of all of Genesis that's promising an offspring. We need genealogy. And now the main character doesn't have a child. God, in light of these promises, I recognize the world is under a curse. And you've set me apart to be the one through whom the blessing will come. This is not going to work. I don't have a child. And God said, come outside. Look at the stars. So shall your offspring be. Every single day of your life, when there's not a cloud in the sky, I will give you a reminder of what I have promised. Now, this is going to get really big when we get to Numbers chapter 24, and Balaam prophesies under the inspiration of God, and we're told that a star, not many stars, but a star will rise from Jacob. Because all these stars in the sky, all of them were merely pointers to Abraham that one was coming. That's what he needed. He needed the single offspring. God said, your offspring will be as numerous as the stars in the sky, but it would only come if the one came. And God promises in Numbers 24 that a star will rise, and when that star rises, all the rest of the stars in the sky's lights will grow strangely dim in light of his beauty and grace. They're hoping for the light of the world. They're hoping for the single star. And all the stars in the sky were for Abraham pointers to the hope. A hope stretching all the way back into the Garden of Eden. A hope that a deliverer would rise. Notice the nature of faith. Why did Sarah laugh and say, shall I indeed bear a child now that I am old? Is anything too hard for the Lord? That's the context of faith. Abraham was having to trust God to do for him what he couldn't do on his own, but that's not it. Abraham was trusting God to do for him what he could not do on his own, specifically in relation to the promise of the ultimate offspring. And Paul says, that's faith, Christian. Trusting God to do for us ultimately through the offspring who would come. Two stages. This just helps us put the whole rest of the story together. When God promised Abraham, when he told Abraham was surrounded by the two commands, go to the land and be a blessing. And then there's promises associated with going to the land. That is, he'll become a great nation. There'll be people and there'll be property. And then stage two is, be a blessing once you arrive. Display my greatness. The opposite of a blessing would be the curse. And the curse is what Satan brought about. So blessing must be more in line with what God's called for. Display me, image me, be a blessing. And it's only when one rises who will be a blessing that the world will finally be blessed. There's a tension all throughout the Bible until Jesus comes, because obedience keeps getting called for. God's faithfulness is lifted up, but the world will only be blessed when someone is a blessing. And all the Old Testament is filled with failures. And then Jesus comes at the fullness of time, born of a woman, born under the law, to redeem those under the law. And not only those under the law, but all the rest of the world. Jesus is what Adam was supposed to be. He's the last Adam. But Jesus is also the ultimate son of David, the representative of Israel. Here's the two stages. When the sun went down, behold, a smoking fire pot and a flaming torch passed between these pieces. On that day, the Lord made a covenant with Abram, saying, to your offspring, I'll give this land. Now think about Moses writing about a smoking fire pot moving between two animal parts. How would Israel have understood this smoking fire pot? What would have come to their mind? What do you think? Probably the pillar of cloud by day and the pillar of fire by night. Abram's sleeping. The animal parts are separated, and it's God who's going between the parts. And by this declaring, I believe, let happen to me what's happened to these animals if I fail in my promise. And what is he promising? That a nation would rise, that would have property, and that would have progeny. But that's only stage one. Because once the nation comes together, ultimately they'll be represented by a king. And the blessing, they will be a blessing, or he will be a blessing. And then finally we'll move into stage two. Stage two is highlighted in Genesis 17. Behold, my covenant is with you, and you shall be the father of a multitude of nations. Abraham's father reaching out beyond the Jew to also to the Greek. In Genesis 15 and 17, we see the two stages of the Bible. The old covenant with Moses is the extension of what God started with Abraham. They are the ones that God gives the land to. They are the nation. And then they ultimately are represented by their king, Jesus, who becomes the representative father, wonderful counselor, mighty God, everlasting father. He is representative of Abraham's fatherhood over all the nations. That's the New Testament. The Abrahamic covenant, in the way that it's shaped, it has two stages. That's how it's being shaped. Israel is set apart that through them the world would be blessed. But as a nation, they're going to fail. But as one representing them, they will succeed. Here's how Moses talks about it. I'll surely bless you. I'll surely multiply your offspring, says God to Abram. as the stars of the heavens and as the sand in the seashore. So that seems like Isaac, so Genesis 22 is about the sacrifice of Isaac. Take your son, your only son, Isaac, whom you love. But God, you just set it up. You said Hagar's not going to work. You said a child of my own loins will be my offspring. Through Isaac will my offspring be reckoned. And now you're telling me to take him to a mountain? But he had 40 years of walking with God, God proving himself over and over again, not only to him as an individual, but to him and Sarah as a couple. Sarah was there when God showed up with two other angels in the flesh as the angel of Yahweh. And then he's just talking as Yahweh. He's talking. And because Jesus said no one has seen the Father, it suggests to me that that's the Son. The Son is standing there. This eternal Son of God, I think, is talking to Abram. And then he sends the two angels off to Sodom and Gomorrah, having declared judgment on the city. Sarah was there. Abram was there. And then it happens. This isn't just one man saying, God told me this. It's spread out over 40 years, and then it's proven over and over again. And now it's to this man that God says, take your son, your only son. And he begins to walk, and he goes to Moriah. And he tells the two servants, stay here. My son and I will go and worship, and then we will return. He is so confident, says the writer to the Hebrews. He even believed in the resurrection. Where does he get that? He gets it, I think, from Abram at the end of his life. He's so confident in his God. God has proven his believability, and the promises are truly desirable. And he is unswerving in his faith. We will return, even if I have to sacrifice my son, because God will be faithful to his promise. He said, I will raise up a male offspring. Look at what he says in Genesis 22, right in this context. So I'll bless you, Abraham. I'll surely multiply you and your offspring as the stars in the heaven and as the sand in the sea. And then, so remember that offspring, is it male or, I mean, is it singular or plural? And your offspring shall possess the gate of his enemies. And through your offspring, all the nations of the earth will be blessed. This is the second time in the book that I think God is explicit that the offspring is a male. Notice what it says. We first talk about turf. This male offspring will have land, and he'll have enemies. His dominion will expand, it says, to possess enemy city-states. He'll possess the gate of those who were once enemies. They will be claimed by the offspring of Abraham. And now, it's not just generally, through you, Abraham, all the world will be blessed. No, even here in Genesis 22, the promise is focused. It's one specific male offspring of Abraham, through whom? Who will serve as the instrument of blessing. Already, it's not strange then when we get to Galatians chapter 3:16 that Paul says the promises were made to Abraham and to his seed. It doesn't say and to seeds, plural. It says and to his seed, that is Christ. Paul's just reading his Bible carefully, keeping his eyes on things like pronouns. Genesis 49 takes us even one step further. It's not just the offspring of the woman. It's not just the male offspring of Abraham. He's going to come in the line of Judah. So Abraham has Isaac. Isaac has 12 boys, one of whom is Judah. The older three have forfeited their status, Reuben, Simeon, and Levi, due to sins stressed in the book. Now Judah, who also had sinned, has now redeemed himself in the context of the Joseph story. And in Genesis 49, at the end of his life, Jacob blesses his boys. What does he tell us about Judah? Judah, your brothers shall praise you. Your hand shall be on the neck of your enemies. Your father's sons shall bow down before you. He's going to be worthy of worship. The scepter, that reigning staff of rulership, shall not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet, until tribute comes to him, and to him shall be the obedience of the peoples. This seems to be in the same line. We're expecting a deliverer who will overcome all the curse of the world. That deliverer will be now in the line of Abraham. That deliverer will come from Judah, and he'll be a king. So even by the end of the first book in the Bible, we're expecting a male ruler upon whom all the hope of the world is riding. The story of God's glory through Jesus. Here's the end of this stage. What's the whole Joseph story about? Why is it here? God is preserving the people through whom the offspring will come. God sent me, Joseph says, before you to his brothers. He sent me before you to preserve for you a remnant on earth, to keep you alive, to keep alive for you many survivors. So it was not you who sent me here, but God. What? Yes. It seems like my little life is just operating as it goes. At 17 years old, Joseph gets thrown into a pit. He gets sold to the Ishmaelites. He gets carried off into prison at 17, and he's there until age 30 in prison because of God. Because God was shaping a man. God was readying a picture of a more ultimate Savior. He was going to preserve a people through this single ruler with whom God was with Joseph. God was with Joseph. God was with Joseph. And now, Emmanuel is with us. Joseph's life is this picture set up to say, yes, I care. Yes, I remember. But as we read it, we're not just supposed to see him preserving Israel. In the context of the book, the story of Joseph is for you and for me. Because it's from this nation that is preserved out of famine in Egypt that God will raise up the king. The king who will solve all the world's problems. As for you, you meant evil against me, but God meant it for good. To bring it about that many should be kept alive as they are today. And that's not where the story ends. Joseph adds this comment. It's a comment about hope. Because God isn't just concerned about a people, he's concerned about a place. God's reign over God's people in God's land, that's the kingdom of God. And so Joseph, at the end of the book, all these chapters have been so focused on the offspring promise, preserving the people of Israel. And then he says this, I'm about to die, but God will visit you and bring you up out of this land to the land that he swore to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. God will surely visit you, and you shall carry my bones up from there. That's a little carrot. It throws it out to you and I, the reader, right up in front of us. Let's look for that. Let's look for that. And when we come to the end of the book of Joshua, second or third to the last verse of the book, out of the blue, it says, and they buried the bones of Joseph in the land. What is that saying? God is faithful. The book of Genesis is a kingdom prologue. It's giving Israel, whose story controls all the rest of the Old Testament, it's giving Israel and us, the reader, because that's just one part of our Bible. As Christians, we're here at the end of the story, looking backwards, seeing how we relate to Israel and how Israel relates to the world. That's what Genesis does. It sets up and gives clarity to the people of Israel to know what their marching orders are supposed to be, what their identity is about. It's about, ultimately, raising up the offspring. That's what they're hoping in. And that's what the majority of Israel, as we will see, stops hoping in. They, rather than being like Adam and displaying God to the world as Adam was called to do, that's what Israel was called to do, they end up being like Adam and sinning and get kicked out of their land. A father who is given a son, and that son is a picture of the ultimate hope. He's given promises of offspring, promises of a home, and promises that through him all the world would be blessed. What we're going to see is that the first part of these is fulfilled as Exodus begins. It's initially fulfilled, and every time one of these three promises begins to be fulfilled, a new covenant comes about. So the offspring promise begins to be fulfilled. Israel fills and multiplies, and that gives Pharaoh problems. And God redeems them and brings about the old Mosaic covenant. God carries them into the land, and 2 Samuel 7 tells us the land was at rest. There was no war. And in 2 Samuel 7, right after saying that, God makes a covenant with David, focusing in the offspring promise on one specific line within the line of Judah. And then when he is ready and he raises up the son of David, it's through Jesus now that the new covenant comes and the offspring gives rise to blessing. Through Jesus, the north, the south, the east, and the west enjoy the blessing of God. And you and I get to benefit of that. Kickoff and rebellion, instrument of blessing. So we have, let's go through it one more time. Kickoff and rebellion, say it with me. K, kickoff and rebellion. I, instrument of blessing. N, nation redeemed and commissioned. G, government in the land. D, dispersion and return. O, overlap of the ages. M, mission accomplished. Father Abraham rejoiced that he would see Jesus' day. He saw it and was glad.
Thank you for listening to this message from the ministry of Dr. Jason Deroshi, Associate Professor of Old Testament at Bethlehem College and Seminary in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Feel free to make copies of this message to give to others, but please do not charge for these copies or alter their content in any way without written permission from Jason Deroshi. For more information on Bethlehem College and Seminary, we invite you to visit online at bcsmn.org. For more information on Dr. Deroshi, visit online at deroshi-meyer.org. Proclaiming the kingdom and treasuring a God who rules, saves, and satisfies through covenant for his glory in Christ.